Australia's military history is more than just a collection of dates and the locations of war-ravaged battlefields. It is the stories of service and sacrifice of those who have answered the call of their country of birth or adoption and the enduring legacy they have created. Join me as we look into one of those stories. I'm your host, Ross Manuel, and welcome to I Was Only Doing My Job, Australia's Military History, a Doc Network podcast. Now let's get started. G'day folks, and welcome to a special edition of the podcast. To mark the end of History Talk Shipwreck Summer Series, I am pleased to have with me some very special guests, and the three of us will be sharing with you our own personal favourite shipwreck stories, and we hope that you like them. Joining me today is friend of the podcast, Melissa Ratliff of God's Favourites, a history podcast, and Ryan Day from the History Daddy YouTube channel. Now, you will notice the audio is a little off in times as we recorded this over two separate sessions, and we did have some recording issues. But hopefully you enjoy it. Before we started the recording the first time, we decided that Ryan would start us off. So Ryan, take it away.
Thank you, Ross. My name is Ryan, otherwise known as History Daddy. I can be found on TikTok, Instagram Reels, and YouTube Shorts, making short, funny historical sketches. And I'm also on YouTube making longer form historical content, sort of comedic, sort of educational. And today I'm going to be talking about the wreckage of the Bismarck.
So let's get going, making sure I've got my little notes in the corner here. So the Bismarck, now the reason that the Bismarck is such an important piece of British military history, being ironic because it is, the Germans also consider it an important piece of their history. So this was meant to be like the greatest capital ship that was ever built. This thing could eviscerate, and it was a scary ship to go up against. You wouldn't want to go up. Like most ships at the time, it would be like Thor in that scene in Avengers 1 when the Hulk smashed him backwards and forwards. Loki rather. He does do it to Thor as well, but I mean Loki. It's definitely an easy mistake to make the two of those characters out. I'm not going to get picked apart by Marvel fans for that. The Bismarck is off. It's trying to go up through the North Atlantic. I believe it's going past Greenland at this point. I could be wrong, and if I am wrong, feel free to comment on it in the comments. Do you have comments on Spotify on that?
Yeah, we can.
I don't know how.
Don't give me a bad ranking if he messes up. So
yeah.
Don't rank the podcast on Ryan.
I've lost where I am now. That's it. Right, so we're going past Greenland at this point, and The Bismarck and the Prinz Eugen, I apologise for all of my pronunciations on the German ships, they're not going to be amazing, but is intercepted by the HMS Hood, which is a very symbolic ship to the British Navy at this time, and the HMS Prince of Wales. Now, the HMS Hood and the HMS Prince of Wales engage the Bismarck and the Prinz Eugen, who I'm going to stop saying because I've realised the Prinz Eugen I'm definitely mispronouncing, so I'm just going to stick to the Bismarck for now. So they engage both these ships, and the HMS Hood gets sunk. Now, this creates a big issue for the Royal Navy. One, we know that there's a massive capital ship, one of the most destructive ships ever built, on our way to harass our supply lines coming in from America. And as we all know, we don't mess with American ships when involved in a world war. And there's also the backfire of this is such a symbolic defeat, and the symbolic defeat is always worse than a symbolic victory. So now the Royal Navy's entire mission is to take out the Bismarck. And when I say this, like, not a lot of people report on it, the amount of resources that were diverted to simply take out the Bismarck is unreal. So the Bismarck, the Admiral, whose name I've already forgotten, this is why I have the notes up, because I knew I'd forget. Admiral Lugin, I believe it was. I might be pronouncing that wrong. Yeah, it's Lugin. Yeah. So he starts planning, and he's immediately making his moves to go, okay, so yeah, Gunter Lugin, there it is. He starts planning. He's like, okay, the Royal Navy's after me, I need to make move. His captain, whose name also eludes me, I apologize, I said I'd forget all the names as I went along. His captain immediately starts going, okay, right, we need to move back to Norway. And Admiral Lugin is like, no, we're gonna go down to France, because the British are all around. Which, to be fair, logic does dictate the British Navy would be around the British Isles on the way back to Norway. So I can understand his logic behind it. But at the same time, at this point, after the engagement with the HMS Hood, and I mean, HMS Prince of Wales did get away, after this engagement, the Bismarck is leaking fuel. There's not really any damage to crew or armaments, but you are leaking fuel and you're listing slightly. So you want to go to the quickest route, and I would risk the engagement. Again, you are still the most powerful ship. So personally, I would have wanted him to help. I'm not siding with the Germans here, people, before I get... This is what I meant when I said before the podcast, this story depends on your point of view, if it's sad or not. Because there's definitely some people online that are probably unsad in it. We don't talk about those people online. But, so Bismarck continues its journey down south to France, where it then begins its interception from the British Royal Navy. And this is where you get the true might of the British Navy come out, because I think there's 6 or 7 ships at this point that are cruising after the Bismarck. Can I take a quick pause for questions? I don't know how the...
I would just, you know, you said it's the Americans, and I guess you Pearl Harbor, Satania.
Yes.
But it sounds like you guys are a little more hardcore. 6 ships are ready to fight for this.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole hunting for the Bismarck directly impacts upon the reinforcement of the South Pacific British territories. So Singapore and basically the whole Singapore strategy. So basically all of Australia and New Zealand's strategic policy for potential threats with a war with Japan is completely thrown out the window because of Bismarck. Like, because of all the ships that would have been tasked to a South Pacific fleet have all been retasked to hunt this one battleship.
Yep.
Which means none of them are in position when the Japanese attack in the 7th and 8th of December.
The impact this one ship, which is why you get a lot of German nationalists, will say, to get around all any filters that we have on any social media sites. The German nationalists will often, like, they will hype up the Austrian Painters Fan Club, as I sometimes like to call them, to... They will hype up the importance of the Bismarck, because the amount of effort that went into catching the Bismarck derailed a lot of other military operations. And the British Empire, being the British Empire, was like, well, we'll start sacrificing colonies. That was most colonial empires in a war. It was like, okay, so we'll start sacrificing everything else first. But so as the chase begins, now you have the HMS Prince of Wales, who is itself... wounded, is that I've heard a lot of naval people say it's limping, which is, I always find that a very, very interesting way to describe an injured ship. It's limping. I suppose when it lists, it's like slightly sideways, isn't it? So I can see where the analogy comes from. But it's chased by the HMS Prince of Wales, the HMS Norfolk, which is a battleship and a heavy cruiser, and the HMS Suffolk. The HMS Suffolk is incredibly important because it has a very long-range radar, which means that the British ships can hang back and shadow without getting absolutely ripped apart by the Bismarck's guns, side note, and I'm trying so hard to stay on target because I always do tangent side notes. The Bismarck's guns was one of the things that the Austrian painter was obsessed with putting on a tank. He wanted to build a tank with the ship guns. And if you know how ship guns work, with how deep they go down into the ship, it's so physically impossible. And but then again, he was on coke and meth at the time. Yeah.
Good old tank is chocolate.
Yeah, his doctor. I would love, if I could interview anyone from history, I'd love to interview his doctor. I'd be like, was you doing this on purpose, or was like was you genuinely recommending this? I'm hoping you was doing it on purpose, because that would like slightly make you a better person.
Make you a better person, yeah, slightly.
Yeah. And the other ships that we have under Admiral John Tovey is the HMS George V, which is a battleship, the HMS Victorious, which is an aircraft carrier, and the HMS Repulse, which is also a battle cruiser. I'm not too au fait with the classes of ships, so I may be saying these classes of ships doesn't mean I know entirely what they are. I know what battleships and carriers are, obviously. Battlecruiser, I believe, is slightly smaller than the battleship, isn't it? But it's like slightly faster.
Guns, light armor.
Yeah. Ironically, I get better with the classes of ship when we go back to antiquity, but I'm not as good with the shipwrecks. Obviously, I'm better with the antiquity. Ancient Greece is my obsession.
Find a shipwreck that involved Alexander the Great.
Because a lot when you look at shipwrecks that far back, it's hard to find specific names, and you tend instead of shipwrecks, you just get entire battles. Like I was very tempted to just do that time the Romans destroyed the entire Carthaginian fleet just for the lulz. So, anyways, the Bismarck circles back at some point during the chase, and he circles back to engage and allow the Prince Eugen to get away so he can go off and harass the supply lines. I am emphasizing the harassing of the supply lines because it will make sense at the end, because the chase of the Bismarck had one very big impact on supply lines in World War II. So the Bismarck carries back, attacks the British convoy, and then carries on, still being shadowed. But this gave the HMS Victorious enough time to catch up and send off an array of aeroplanes. However, they mistakenly attacked the HMS Norfolk first, which is where normally the joke it is when military history is the Americans that tend to have the militaristic blunders. No offense. So, but this entire operation was blunder after blunder for the British Navy. As much as I do like to hype up the British Navy in World War II, this whole operation went south very quickly. However, they immediately course corrected because they realised they didn't actually they didn't launch directly on the Norfolk, so there was no damage done. They were being shot at by the Bismarck at this point with the anti-aircraft guns, but the Germans missed every shot. Like, not a single plane was downed. So the British messed up, the Germans immediately have an easy target of all these planes, don't hit a single one, and then the Bismarck gets whacked itself. Like, this is why the Bismarck story is low-key funny. Or, yes, Ross?
Wasn't there, like, a US Coast Guard ship, like, between the British and the Bismarck?
I think so, possibly.
Sorry.
I like the idea that the Americans are just like, this is not where I want to be right now.
The worst part about it was the Coast Guard ship couldn't range find for the Royal Navy ship because that would have been make them active belligerent. But also they couldn't then broadcast out, "Boy, leave us alone," because it would have made them an active target.
Because the second the target comes up, wait, there's another ship, wait, who's...
Hold on. We're not even involved yet. We're not involved as part of it. We always involve less.
Yeah.
We weren't even involved.
We need help with our dictator. Oh, sorry, we're busy. But, okay, well, what are we going to do with all this oil?
We're going to quietly build up our patrol.
Yep. Right, so at this point, after this attack... Lugens manages to evade the British fleet. He does successfully do this with the minor damage to the Bismarck. She is still listing, and there is now some issues with the crew. Now, here is where Lugens makes the biggest mistake that I think actually allowed the Royal Navy to get in. This was, in my opinion, people will disagree, there's certain points where you can argue was the final straw for the Bismarck. Lugens breaks radio silence, and he's not, without encoding anything, starts sending out Morse code, but everyone knows Morse code. So he starts sending out Morse code signals to Vichy France, no, not Vichy France, the occupied bit, the northern bit of France. Austrian painter occupied France. He starts sending out Morse code saying, "Oh yeah, we're coming in this way, we're going just past the British Isles at this point." And in Bletchley Park, which if you've ever done any stuff with Alan Turing or stuff like that, you'll know is the massive code breaking area. And they immediately just sitting there like, this guy's telling us where to go. He's just broadcast it out, and it's not even like Enigma or anything. So the Royal Navy are like, okay, so do we just start like sending people over, like, and they do. And the issue is most of the Royal Navy ships now under Tovey's command are running out of fuel, which is a big issue with ships. They need a lot of fuel. They can't exactly, you know, pop down to your local Asda and fill up on petrol or gas, depending. And so they start going on, I believe it's the HMS George V, the Norfolk, and the Rodney, which is my favourite name for a ship ever. If you've ever watched Only Fools and Horses, you know why that's such a hilarious name for a ship. Now, from Loch Earney, and I apologise to everyone in Northern Ireland for the horrific pronunciation of Ernie. I know that's not how it's done, but my Essex accent comes through. The PBY Catalina, which is an aerial reconnaissance vehicle, takes off and starts flying around the Atlantic Ocean nearby France and spots an oil slick. And obviously, as things are progressing, they're going, well, we know something is leaking fuel because everyone's been going on about it. Oh, look, there's the Bismarck. So they realise, OK, we found the Bismarck. So we had the radio. We knew where to look. We found the Bismarck. That's the good news. The bad news is that he's less than a day away from, I believe it's Saint-Nazaire and Brest. And that means the Luftwaffe can provide aerial defence. And obviously, as the Battle of Midway would prove, aerial fighters can completely change a naval battlefield. And so, as the Bismarck's producing, I believe it's Battle Group H. Battle Group H, which is the HMS Ark Royal, the aircraft carrier, and the HMS Renown. These start harassing the Bismarck. They have to harass it and bring it in. Again, we launch a aerial raid, and this is the second big blunder for the Royal Navy that could have allowed the Bismarck to get away had it not sort of course adjusted. Literally, this entire operation is the British getting amazingly lucky. So the HMS Sheffield, which is a light cruiser, is tasked with going after the Bismarck, like keeping radio contact and shadowing it. The air squadron that sent out, they attack the Sheffield because they're not aware of the prior orders. Luckily, the bombs all fail. They've got like new magnet detonation things, and these all fail. And it's obviously sitting there, you know, mission failed successfully. They then launch another air attack on the Bismarck, which does work, and it breaks down both the rudders. They manage to fix one rudder, but the other rudder jams, and this literally sends the Bismarck into loop-de-loops. So now the last of Tovey's fleet, which, if I go through my notes again, this is absolute professionalism. I'm sorry for both of you trying to edit this out afterwards. The HMS King George V and the best ship, HMS Rodney, come back into the fray. So this just gives them time to, because they can't send the Luftwaffe out, and there's no other German naval support that can do it because they're all busy trying to take out the supply lines. Desperately trying not to sink ships, and later saying to their LA, hey, maybe don't sink the American ships. And Japan's like, yeah, so definitely sink the American ships. I'm going to run the American ship joke into the ground by the end of this. It's fine. The HMS Norfolk, the HMS Dorsetshire. I'd say Dorsetshire, but I'm going to go for the American audiences. Dorchestershire. Yeah. And obviously, so everyone's engaging. And when I, like, the amount of ships engaging one capital ship at this point, it's literally like the end of, it's not A New Hope, it's Empire Strikes Back when they destroy the first Death Star in it, yeah. It's literally that, like, all of these tiny ships are just flying around desperately shelling. And the Bismarck is mildly poor language, screwed at this point. There's no way it's getting out of this. It's surrounded, it's being shelled from every angle. The captain of the Bismarck is sitting there going, I told you so, we should have gone through Norway. And there's no way that the Bismarck, also, as bits are coming back to me as we're going along, the Bismarck kept missing. And the reason for this was because the rudder was jammed. They couldn't target because it kept moving, so it's listing and it's the rudder's jammed, so they keep missing their targets, and it's literally just like everywhere. I'm really glad this isn't visual because I realised what I started doing with my hands then.
Keep the Benny Hill music playing.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And so the Bismarck's going down at this point. A lot of the Austrian painter fans that I've encountered on land immediately bring up, but Lugin scuttled it. The British didn't sink it. That it was being scuttled because we didn't want you to take it. And I always go, one, the British did not want to take the Bismarck. They wanted to sink the Bismarck. If you look at all the memos and all the stuff, all of the orders was sink the Bismarck. The victory of the image of sinking the thing that sunk the hood was more important than getting any of the technology that was on the Bismarck. And most of that technology was simply, it bigger, that make it good, which was the entire philosophy of World War II German engineering, was make it bigger, then it's good. And so, now, the reason I bring up the scuttling is for a key important thing, is the Bismarck was actually so well built that the scuttling didn't sink it. So the all of the British naval attacks and the scuttling didn't actually sink it until it was so destroyed that the British, and this is my final proof that the British definitely wanted to sink it, was the HMS Dorsetshire was left on its own with a broken Bismarck. It was just sitting there on fire and just occasionally dropping a shell off every now and then just to finish this ship and sink it. And that was it. That was all it was job. Just imagine you're sitting there. Everyone else has gone home for like tea and biscuits and you're just sitting there going, oh, sugar, I was meant to fire a shell off 15 minutes ago. Bang. Like just sitting there with a cup of tea, just going like at this point, it's literally the Simpsons meme of stop it. He's already dead. Like that was all they were doing.
The dead horse right
now. And then I can't remember what the exact time was. There's definitely some history nerds out there that will get that spotted. But the Bismarck went down and I believe it flipped upside down. And the guns fell off. And we have since found the wreckage of the Bismarck.
It's Bob Ballard, the guy who found the
top. I didn't know that.
Wall That's... World.
It all links together, and I believe.
I think he.
But yeah. That's it. We should just, if there's ever a ship you can't find, you just phone him up like, my guy, just want to come down. He's like, I've already did it last night. I was like, what do you mean? I was like, I had a feeling he was going to call, so I just you know, on a whim. But to finish off, there was 2,200 souls that were lost at sea with the sinking of the Bismarck. I don't know the figures for the Hood. When you're looking at the Bismarck, even though the Hood is so pivotal to the story of the Bismarck, it tends to get like thrown to the side as more of a plot point to start the story. But the final closing message of the reason the Bismarck was such a pivotal moment and it's remembered is obviously national pride for the British. In Australia and New Zealand, it's highlighted as like how it damaged the war effort in the Pacific. The big key point. This was when the Germans fully went on board with U-boats, which, if you've ever spoken to an older person in the UK, U-boats and doodlebugs is the thing. My nan used to talk about doodlebugs a lot, which was the bombs when they'd come off, stop, silence, and then drop. And U-boats was obviously the terrifying. So it changed how the Germans viewed war. It wasn't this big bold. It was very similar to how warfare went from two armies lining up in brightly coloured uniforms and splattering each other until they ran out of men into like hiding in between tree lines. And it changed. It became more secretive and you was trying to, I mean, how you can hide a massive battleship is hard. You can't hide an aircraft carrier, but you can hide U-boats, you can hide submarines. And that is how naval battles, and that would change, reinvigorate into the Cold War and everything. And that's I tried to keep myself short there, but I know I went on quite a tangent on the Bismarck. But yeah, that's the story of the Bismarck. Sorry if I went on a bit too long there. Sorry.
No, I loved it. That's great. I'm gonna let it spin around and
yeah, job is done. That's my favorite story, just going boop, boop. Is it sunk yet? No, boop.
So now it's my turn, and you've probably noticed an improvement in the audio quality. That's because the last time we did this, Ryan's was the only one that actually worked. Now, in the original version, I had covered His Majesty's Australian Submarines AE-1 and AE-2, and ended up just depressing everyone. So, since our last session, I've also done separate episodes on both boats. So, instead of rehashing this, I've decided to cover Australia's only ever battlecruiser, HMAS Australia 1. But before we get to her and her sinking, sorry.
Oh, I just said, let's go.
Yeah, I'm ready. Let's go. But before we get to her and her sinking, we have to go to the 1909 and go back to 1909 and the Imperial Conference for Defence. Because Australia, a brand new country as of 1901, had been acknowledged as a dominion in the previous 1907 conference, had Australians representatives, including the Prime Minister, Andrew Fisher, and reps from the other dominions, so Newfoundland, New Zealand, South Africa, and India, along with colonial representatives in the British government, were told to their horror by the First Lord of the Admiralty, Sir Reginald McKenna, that the British Empire, so Royal Britannia, would no longer had control of the waves. Despite having 100 years of dominance, United States and Germany were making the dreadnought gap much, much smaller. And that sent shockwaves throughout the empire. Who, the other dominions, they suggested to throw money at this issue, but Australia was hesitant to participate because, well, let's face it, we'd only been a country for 9 years. That was until the Admiralty informed Prime Minister Fisher that the Anglo-Japanese alliance was set to expire in 1915. And with rising power in German colonial forces in the South Pacific, basically on Australia's doorstep, meant that if tensions turned into war in Europe, the Royal Navy was not going to be able to protect Australia, which is exactly the same issue that plagued Australia during the Second World War. Understandably, this tactic worked, and Australia agreed to purchase a fleet unit, what we'd now call a battle group, built around a battle cruiser, three cruisers, three destroyers, and three submarines. Now, the British government had actually offered to partly pay for this fleet unit as they had to the other Dominions. Basically, they would pay and bill for the ships, but then they would send them to the Dominions and then charge them for the upkeep. And ironically, Australia was the only one who actually took them up on this and decided to go all in on it. So they would pay entirely out of their own budget, which enforced the notion this was an Australian Navy. They would, in peacetime, protect anti-piracy, trade protection, illegal fishing and smuggling around Australian and territorial waters. But due to Australian policy at the time, in the event of the war that was going to happen, the Australian squadron, which was what the fleet unit was called, would revert tactical control back to the Royal Navy. And which is interesting, because despite all that initial support, where all the Dominions like, we'll throw money at this problem, not a single one of them took the Royal Navy up on it. The centerpiece of this fleet unit was, as suggested, the 17,055-ton Indefatigable-class battlecruiser HMAS Australia, who also served as the flagship of the fleet. She was one of three ships of the class, her other ships being His Majesty's ships Indefatigable and New Zealand, who will factor in this story quite a lot. The Australian government went with the name Australia to mainly avoid showing any favoritism towards any particular state or city, as at the time, Australia didn't have a capital. A temporary seat of power was in Melbourne, and it wouldn't be until 1913 that Canberra was founded as the capital. And Sydney was still sore at the fact that he didn't miss out on the opportunity. So any time to stop the argument between these two seats, good idea.
What's bad is I genuinely thought Sydney was the capital of Australia.
No, I thought that too, and I was like, I'm like, I'm not going to say anything because I'm an American, and everyone assumes I don't know anything. Ryan speaking out makes me feel better. Carry on.
Sydney thinks they're the capital.
I'm sold on it. I thought Sydney thought they were the capital, so I wasn't going to argue.
Sydney's just very good at propagandizing the rest of the world that they are the capital.
So Australia was ordered from the John Brown and Company shipyards in Glasgow in March 1910 at an expected cost of £2 million, or about $311,407,548.97 in today's money. HMAS Australia was 179.83 metres or 590 freedom units long, 24.38 metres or 80 freedom units wide, and a speed of 25 knots or 46 kilometres per hour or 29 miles per hour. She was powered by 39 coal burners, firing 4 steam turbines, powering 4 propellers, which is quite fast for a ship of the size of its time. Australia carried 8 12-inch Mark 10 guns in 4 twin turrets, the largest guns fitted to any Australian warship. 2 turrets were mounted fore and aft of the centre line, identified as A and X respectively. The other 2 were wing turrets mounted amidships and staggered diagonally, which meant that, theoretically, she could fire broadsides. I've never seen any evidence that she did. Her secondary armament was a 16 4-inch guns mounted in the superstructure, and she had 2 submerged torpedo tubes with 18-inch torpedoes, with which 12 torpedoes were carried. She was launched on the 25th of October, 1911, at 295,000 pounds under budget, which is pretty impressive for the Navy. After a successful sea and gunnery trial, she was commissioned as an Australian vessel in Portsmouth on the 21st of June, 1913, with Captain Sidney Radcliffe, Royal Navy, in command. And 2 days later, she flew the flag of Rear Admiral George Edwin Patey, Royal Navy, who had been selected to command the Australian fleet, because at the time, Australia had a grand total of 48 native-born naval personnel. Australia's complement is 890. On the 23rd of July, 1913, accompanied by HMAS Sydney, Australia departed Portsmouth and headed home by way of Cape Town to enforce to the Dominions, look what we have, and then headed straight across the Indian Ocean to Albany, Western Australia, then Melbourne, and eventually reaching Sydney on the 4th of October, 1913, and led the rest of the Australian fleet, the cruisers HMAS Melbourne, Sydney, and Encounter, along with the destroyers Warrego, Parramatta, and Yarra. Now, the 2 submarines that were supposed to join them weren't redelivered for another year. When Australia entered Port Jackson, which is Sydney's actual name, the fanfare was apparently off the charts, as Sydney itself had been used to seeing capital ships. This was the first time that capital ship was Australian. The Sydney Mail at the time reported, quote, "The sight of the fleet meant more to the Australian people than the visit of any foreign fleet. It was our expression of patriotism. Ships of defence brought in love of country and empire," unquote. And the Australian Defence Minister, Senator Edwin Milne, remarked, quote, "Since Captain Cook's arrival, no more memorable event has happened than the advent of the Australian fleet. As the former marked the birth of Australia, so the latter announces its coming of age, its recognition and growing responsibilities of nationhood, and its resolve to accept and discharge them as duty both to itself and to the empire. The Australian fleet is not merely the embodiment of force, it is the expression of Australia's posture to pursue in freedom its national ideals. and to hand down unimpaired and unsullied the heritage it hath received, in which it holds and cherishes an inviolable trust. It is in the spirit that Australia welcomes its fleet, not as an instrument of war, but as a harbinger of peace. Now, for the year that followed, the Australian government did what you did when you get a shiny new battlecruiser. You show it off, especially around the north of the country, where there are German territories about, you know, not far from there, where there's a whole German squadron operating in the same waters. Harbinger of peace.
What can go wrong, though?
What can go wrong? So, ironically, though, with Australia's arrival in the Southern Hemisphere, it is automatically the most powerful warship in the Southern Hemisphere by degrees of magnitude. And the Australian squadron, with that accompaniment, it was even more so, more potent than the German East Asiatic squadron that was operating in German New Guinea and German Chinese territories. So this whole thing, at the outbreak of the First World War, most people think that Australia and New Zealand's first involvement in the war was at Gallipoli. It actually happened a lot earlier and a lot closer to home, in mid-August 1914. So HMAS Australia in Melbourne steamed with a New Zealand convoy to German New Guinea and entering the harbour and taking the territory without a single shot being fired. Now, at the time, reporters would attribute this to the presence of Australia, but in reality, Berlin had instructed the German garrison to not oppose the Allied landing because they knew they couldn't relieve it if they tried. Departing German Samoa, Australia and Melbourne joined an Australian convoy for German New Guinea on the 2nd of September and deploy picket boats to sweep for mines, but again took no actual fire or did anything before putting back to sea. Her role wasn't to support the landings, but was to wait in ambush for the German cruisers, particularly the Scharnhorst and Gneisenau. Despite this, Australia has the distinction of participating in the first and last amphibious operations of the First World War. 5 days later, Australia would return to Sydney for repairs. Because her presence in the South Pacific and the likelihood of Japan entering the war on the side of the Allies, the commander of the German East Asiatic Squadron, Admiral Count Maximilian von Spee, determined that he did not want his ships anywhere in the area. So he steamed across the Pacific to make for the Atlantic, raiding what Allied territories he could on the way. And because of that, Admiral Peaty was ordered to return to Rabaul to protect the newly acquired territories. In October, the Australian fleet searched for the German one. And by that point, von Spee was already beyond Tahiti. And while Admiral Peaty suspected that's where Germany was heading, the Admiralty wanted Australia and the fleet to stay in the South Pacific to patrol in case the Germans returned, which they did for about October and November until the Battle of Coronel off the coast of Chile, where von Spee handed the Royal Navy their first defeat in over 100 years. Almost immediately, the wireless got to Admiral Peaty and unleashed Australia to pursue because it was the only battle cruiser in the whole area. Departing 8th of November, we reached Camila Bay near Mexico 12 days later, and Peaty took command of a multinational squadron to prevent von Spee from making for Canadian waters or for reaching the Panama Canal or Cape Horn. The plan was to sink the Asiatic squadron in the Pacific. But by the time we got there, they had already made for around the Cape Horn and actually was engaged by the British squadrons at the Battle of the Falkland Islands on the 8th of December. The entire squadron was decimated. Von Spee was killed, his two sons were killed, the entire fleet was destroyed. And understandably, while Australia was near the Panama Canal. So understandably, the Australian personnel were disappointed they didn't have a chance to take on the ships that they were designed to counter. But as the threat of German naval attack had been removed from the destruction of the East Asiatic Squadron, Australia was free to hold deployment elsewhere. And while the Australian Navy escorted convoys via the Mediterranean, Australia was destined to command the West Indies Squadron, with the task of pursuing and destroying any German vessels that invaded the North Sea blockade. The plan was to make for Jamaica via the Panama Canal, but apparently heavy traffic meant that it had to go via Cape Horn, which through the Strait of Magellan, which is the only time that a vessel of the Royal Australian Navy has ever transited to the Atlantic via South America, or every other time we go through the Panama Canal. During the crossing, one of her propellers was damaged, which means she had to limp to Falkland Islands, and we had to go repairs there. On the 5th of January, she departed and found a freighter traveling outside of regular shipping lanes, but couldn't close the distance because she could only travel at 5 knots at the time. Fired a single of fire warning shots and caused a German auxiliary, which was the last of von Spee's fleet, the Ilona Warman, to stop and be captured. And by 1915, the Admiralty saw the need for a dedicated battle cruiser squadron in British waters and tasked Australia to lead one of them. On the 11th of January, while still traveling to Jamaica, Australia was diverted to Gibraltar, reaching there on the 20th of January. The battle cruiser was then ordered to Plymouth, where she arrived on the 28th of January. A refit and was made flagship of the 2nd Battlecruiser Squadron of the Battlecruiser Fleet of the British Grand Fleet on the 22nd of February. It gets better. The squadron was initially formed comprising of Australia and her two sisters, New Zealand and Indefatigable. From then until the 22nd of April 1916, Australia was based at Rosyth, accompanying the Battlecruiser Fleet in a succession of sweeps, patrols, and convoy tasks across the length and breadth of the North Sea and never actually saw action, as what happened with most of the Royal British fleet. Because they'd basically set up a blockade around Jutland, the Royal Navy never encountered the high seas fleet. So if they were ever seen, it was always a false alarm. And as there was a potential seniority conflict, the newly promoted Vice Admiral Patey was reassigned to the West Indies, and Rear Admiral William Packham raised his flag aboard Australia. During 1915 and 1916, most vessels of the Allied surface fleets were mostly doing training and responding to threats that never materialized, which apparently became so monotonous, one sailor aboard HMAS Australia was driven mad and had to be committed.
me going to work every day.
Me too.
I get it. Same, bro.
Because Australian climate is so vastly different to the UK, not long after arriving, there are now 259 cases of respiratory illness of the crew of 829 aboard the ship. This was immediately followed by a measles outbreak in June 1915, which forced the Admiralty to assign a senior fleet surgeon to the ship because they determined that the ship's doctors had no understanding of what hygiene meant.
It's like the HMS Typhoid Mary.
Yeah. So roughly a third of the crew is out with respiratory illnesses.
I feel like all of the doctors just like lied on their CVs and no one bothered to check. Just yeah. Sitting there like, I studied where?
At a school.
Over the rainbow.
On the morning of the 21st of April 1916, the second Battle Cruiser Squadron left for its headquarters at 0400, accompanied by the 4th Life Cruiser Squadron, bound for Skagerrak near Jutland to support efforts to disrupt the transport of Swedish ore to Germany. And while they were at sea, they received word the German High Seas Fleet was mobilizing to conduct their own operation. This apparently was to coincide with the Irish Easter Uprising, which Australians were also used to brutally put down. Glory, love the Empire. All British ships in the area were ordered to rendezvous at a point in the middle of the North Sea with the rest of the battle cruiser squadrons. And at 15:30 on the afternoon of the 22nd of April, the three squadrons of battle cruisers were patrolling together on the northwest of Horn Reeves when a heavy fog hit. While the ships were steaming abreast at about 19 and a half knots with Australia on the port flank, they were automatically concerned about the possibility of submarines. And then orders were issued that the whole fleet was to commence zigzagging. This took some time for instructions to be relayed by signal flag because the Royal Navy didn't have reliable radio communications and also maintain radio silence. It didn't mean until 1540 that Australia and a cruiser her escort were commencing her first zigzag and swung to starboard. Now, the crew were aware that their sister, New Zealand, was on that side about 926 meters away, but due to poor visibility meant that as they made their turn, she didn't see her until it was too late and they hit each other at 1543. Despite Australia attempting to turn away to port, Australia's side was torn open from frames 59 to 78 by the armor plate below the waterline and below her sister's P turret, while New Zealand turned away to her outer port propeller, damaging Australia's hull below her Q turret. It's not over. It gets worse. Australia slowed to half speed as the mist hit her sister ship, but as the damage to New Zealand's propeller caused a loss of control, she swung back in front of Australia, which despite turning to port had her stem crushed at 1546 as she scraped the side of New Zealand just below her behind her P turret. It was blunt. Procedural errors were found to be the cause of the collision, but I honestly say I can't else but think that it's just a coincidence that the ship that collided of all the ships of the battlecruiser fleet, the ship that collided with Australia was New Zealand. Both ships came to a stop about 27 to 37 meters apart from it while their respective officers assessed the damage. And as damage control teams made immediate repairs, off-duty sailors on Australia apparently took advantage of a convenient potato locker to hurl both its contents and insults at the crew of her nearby ship. While New Zealand had a purely British crew, she was a Royal Navy ship, not a Royal New Zealand Navy ship. I can't have to wonder, there has been a degree of Anzac frustration at what had happened here.
Just only a little.
Only a little.
I mean, how bad is the rivalry, though? Honestly, between Australia, I'm assuming it's like
it's not like Canada and America. It's more along the lines of we pick on each other, but if you pick on us, we'll unleash hell on you.
Very much a sibling rivalry.
It's like
we're allowed to say that. We're allowed to say that.
We're allowed to make fun of them, but how dare you?
Yeah.
Now, New Zealand, being the lesser of the two, was soon underway, returning to Rosyth with the rest of the squadron. And ironically, Australia and New Zealand weren't the only two ships to collide in this fog. The battleship Neptune collided with a merchant ship, and the destroyers Ambassade, Ardent, and Garland actually collided with each other. Well, once Astraea was able to make steam at a glacial 12 knots, she headed for Rorsyth a full 24 hours after the rest of the fleet. When she got there, she found dry docks occupied, one of which was with New Zealand. She keeps popping up in the story. Who was having her propeller replaced by one of Astraea's spare propellers. It's like the sibling rivalry. It's like, I take your things.
And yeah, you give me your old...
I like the idea that as the Australians coming up, they're just like immediately, both crews are just like staring at each other as they go past.
The glaring.
Like West Side Story, but like, yeah. it's like your parents are giving you all your older kids, like your older sister and your clothing. And they're going to, here's your old propeller, thanks.
So unfortunately, Australia had to then hobble out of the dock and headed for Newcastle-on-Tyne, approaching a floating duck on the 24th of April. But due to strong winds, she couldn't keep straight bearing and struck the edge of the dock, which bent her port rudder and broke both her port propellers, which meant she had to use indefatigable spare propellers to return to action. She's not doing great. She wasn't able to depart Newcastle-on-Tyne until the 1st of May and unknowingly steamed through a minefield to anchor in the Humber near the Nora lightship. Was undamaged, but went through a whole minefield. And it was like, why did no one notice the minefield? Departing on the 3rd of May, they anchored overnight in Deal, where they witnessed an air raid on the pier on the 6th of May. And while docked there, they were visited by the Australian Prime Minister at the time, Billy Hughes, accompanied by the Australian High Commissioner, Andrew Fisher, the guy who ordered her, and the Senator Alan McDougall. After repairs, she sailed for Rosyth on the 9th of June and missed the only major naval engagement of the First World War, the Battle of Jutland. And guess who took her place in the line as the flagship of the second battlecruiser squadron? You guessed it, HMS New Zealand.
This is just a rivalry at this point.
It is.
Oh my God.
Okay. On her return to service in June 1916, King George V visited the ship and then she continued North Sea patrols as a unit of the British Grand Fleet until the 12th of December 1917, when she collided with another ship. This time it was HMS Repulse. The same HMS Repulse to engage Bismarck.
Yes. Oh, my God.
This caused her to be docked for 3 weeks from December until January 1918. And during that repair period, Astraea actually became the first warship to launch an aircraft when a Sopwith Pup took off from her quarterdeck on the 18th of December. And once repairs were completed, she resumed generally uneventful routine of patrol and fleet exercise in the North Sea. So on the 18th of February 1918, the call went out for volunteers to participate in a special mission to close the port at Zeebrugge using block ships, although many aboard Astraea volunteered for their services in an attempt to escape the drudgery of the North Sea. Only 11 personnel, 10 sailors, and an artificial engineer were selected for the raid, which occurred on the 23rd of April. The artificial engineer was posted to the engine room of the requisitioned HMS Iris II, yet the Australians were assigned to the boiler rooms of the block ship Thetis, or as part of the storming party along the Mole. All of the volunteers survived. Astraea was actually the only ship involved to have no casualties from the raid. One sailor was awarded the Distinguished Service Cross, 3 the Distinguished Service Medal, while another 3 were mentioned in the dispatches. 5 sailors were listed in the ballot to receive the Victoria Cross, but didn't receive them. In fact, it wouldn't be until 2020 when a member of the Australian Navy received the VC. Now, Zeebrugge was the last amphibious operation of the First World War. So that's where Astraea has the distinction of being the first and the last amphibious operations involved. During 1918, Astraea continued the escorts of the North Sea, particularly between Norway and Britain. And from the 7th of March, the battlecruiser tested the capabilities of aircraft launched from platforms mounted over her P&Q turrets. On the 7th of March, 1918, she successfully launched a Sopwith 1.5 Strutter. This was the first ever launching of a 2-seater aircraft from a battlecruiser. She then went on to achieve the first takeoff with a full load on the 4th of April, and launched several more flights without difficulty, including one at anchor. At the end of the war, nearly every British capital ship now carried a Strutter for reconnaissance and a Sopwith Pup or Sopwith Camel as a fighter. Astraea pioneered naval aviation. At the end of the war with the armistice, the German high seas fleet was ordered to sail the Scapa Flow to surrender. While on the way, they were intercepted by the British Grand Fleet, who had been ordered to escort it, with each ship assigned an opposite number. On the 21st of November, Astraea led the port division of the fleet and escorted the most advanced warship in the German Navy, battlecruiser SMS Hindenburg. She was assigned as her guardship and subsequently formed part of the force that guarded the high seas fleet during late 1918 and early 1919 and spent most of her time at anchor at Scapa Flow. The monotonous duty contributed to the already low morale amongst the Australian crew. And the German crew was even worse, so, because they were interred aboard their ships to the point where several German crews scuttled their own warships in camp, in dock. After being formally farewelled by the Prince of Wales and the First Sea Lord, Roslyn Wemyss, on the 22nd of April 1919, Australia departed from Portsmouth for home the next day. She sat in company with HMS Brisbane, but had to travel on her own, arriving in Fremantle on the 28th of May 1919. The first time she'd been home in home waters in 4.5 years. The crew were like exulting to return home. Despite this, she remained under Admiralty control until the 1st of August. Annoyingly, though, Australia was not awarded any official battle honours for her service in the First World War, although the crew and her successor claimed the unofficial operations of the Pacific, the North Sea patrol duties, and the battlecruiser's presence at the surrender of the German high seas fleet. Following the reorganisation of Royal Australian Naval Battle Honours in 2010, the honours Rabaul 1914, North Sea 1915, 1918 were retroactively awarded on the 1st of March 1910. The ship did not get any recognition during her operational service.
Justice for Australia!
Yes.
Yes.
Now, it goes without saying, Australia's ship's company had consistently suffered from low morale since the battle cruise ended service. The proportion of Australia's sailors who were placed on disciplinary charges during the First World War was amongst the highest in the entire Navy. And that's including the Royal Navy.
They're bored.
Yeah. Of course. Exactly.
They were bored.
Exactly. Many of the Australian sailors, and this is just Australians and not the British ones, were chafing under the severity of British naval discipline. And what they saw as excessive punishment for minor breaches. An example was a sailor was charged with desertion, imprisoned for 3 months, and lost all pay for staying out 3 hours extra on Armistice Day.
Brits are just, like, you're not allowed to have fun in the Royal Navy. That's.
I know some people who've been in the British Army and Navy, and they're very strict individuals. They get reprogrammed.
Other factors that contributed to low morale and poor discipline, including frustration at missing the Battle of Jutland, the high rates of illness, the limited opportunities for leave, delays or complete lack of deferred pay, and poor food. The continuation of strict wartime routines and discipline after the armistice frustrated the rest of the crew, and there was also a perception that Australia's British personnel were being promoted faster than their Australian counterparts and were dominating leadership positions, which is true. Most of the senior crew were British. The battlecruiser's arrival in Fremantle on the 28th of May was met with extensive hospitality, which was reciprocated where possible by the sailors with invitations and tours of their vessel. Now, this was the first time ever that the capital ship of the Australian fleet had entered Fremantle. So the crowds were traveling constantly to see her. There were a few opportunities for shore leave, but these were limited to Australia. These were unlimited as Australia was only in port for 3 days and had to sail early on the 1st of June for Melbourne. Representatives of the ship's company approached the commanding officer, Captain Claude Cumberledge, to ask for one extra day on departure, which would allow the sailors to have a full weekend of leave and to give Perth-born personnel a chance to visit their families. This request was refused, and the argument given was due to time constraints. The following morning at around 10:30, between 80 and 100 sailors gathered in front of P turret, some in working uniform, others having just returned from shore leave, still in civvies. The executive officer met the men to find out what was going on, and learning that they were repeating the previous day's request for a delay in departure, and went down to address them in a strict legalistic tone, informed the sailors that delaying Australia's departure was impossible and ordered them to disperse. While the group obeyed, they didn't do so quietly, so when Cumberledge ordered mooring lines released and the ship to get underway, she was informed that the stokers had left the boiler room. And they were either, now, whether it was either willingly or they were coerced to, that remains to be seen. They're rather unclear on the details. Now, this awkwardly left the fleet's flagship stranded in full view of dignitaries and crowds, because they had lined the wharf to see her off, and she just sat there. No smoke, nothing. So senior non-commissioned officers, along with sailors drafted from other departments, were then sent to the boiler room to get her moving, and departed only an hour. But the media went nuts with this. Now, what happened next, though, is very heavily disputed. What is known, though, is five sailors, including one of the Victoria Cross nominees from the Zebra grade, was charged with inciting a mutiny and arrested pending a court-martial, which was held aboard HMAS Encounter on the 20th of June when Australia arrived in Sydney. The ruling given was that five men had, quote, joined a mutiny not accompanied by violence, unquote, and were sentenced to imprisonment in Goulburn Jail, which is actually like 10 minutes down the road from where I am right now. Two were imprisoned for 1 year, one was imprisoned for 18 months, and two were for 2 years with hard labor. A number of other sailors, yeah, for inciting a mutiny because they wanted one extra day.
Man.
Oh,
no fun. But
they're not at war at this point.
No.
There's literally enough. What's the reason they can't?
Exactly.
Was there ever actually a proper reason uncovered, or was it just the we can't delay it? Because
that was literally the reason why they couldn't leave, is because they had to meet a reception in Melbourne with the rest of the fleet, and that was the argument given. But you're the flagship.
Yeah, everyone waits for the flagship.
Apparently, a number of other sailors were also charged with participating in the mutiny while the ship was at sea, but it's unclear if any faced any actual proper court-martial. Following the court-martial of the five ringleaders, there was debate amongst the public, in the media, and within government over the sentences. While most agreed that a mutiny had occurred, there were differences in opinion on the leniency or severity of the punishments. Public sympathy was with the sailors. Of course it was. And several politicians pressured the government and the Admiralty to pardon the men. Now, the Admiralty thought the sentences were fair. So the Admiralty is the British Admiralty, not the Australian. The British, because the Australian legal had to refer to Britain.
Yeah.
But on the 10th of September, announced that their sentences would be halved in consideration of the sailors' youth. Despite this, the controversy continued until the 21st of November, and that's after the Australian government appealed directly to the Admiralty. Basically, it was agreed that the sailors would be released on the 20th of December. However, the government had angered the naval board because they had put to the Australian military officials by bypassing them and going straight to Britain without consulting the board first. And as a result, the first naval member, Rear Admiral Percy Grant, and the commander of the fleet, Commodore John Dumansk, submitted their resignation in protest, as they felt that the show of clemency would lead to a breakdown in discipline, and if government continued to communicate with the Admiralty without consulting the board, it undermined the board's control. They were convinced to withdraw their resignations after receiving assurances that the board would be consulted before all further government communication with Britain, and that notices will be posted in all ships explaining that the sentences were correct, but the onset of peace had led to clemency on this particular case. Yes.
We're overthinking it. I think we're overthinking it a bit, guys. Like, just...
Yeah.
It low-key sounds like the two guys were like, hey, if they can go straight to Britain, like, our jobs are at risk, so we're gonna protest to make it sound like we're more important so that they don't go straight to the Admiralty again.
Basically, that's what happened.
Important too.
That's basically what happened.
You need this extra layer of paperwork, goddamn it.
Yes.
Mr. Rogers episode. Like, you are special just because who you are. And like, just take that meaning to heart and don't be about it.
So in May 1920, Australia participated in celebrations and naval activities associated with the visit of the Prince of Wales. And from July to November 1920, she participated in sea trials to form the creation of Australia's Fleet Air Arm. However, inter-service rivalry and the ship's reduction to non-seagoing status in September prevented further operations. And following the demise of German naval power in the Pacific, the fleet unit concept was no longer seen as relevant, and Australia did not have a clear role in the future of the Navy. As a result, post-war budget cuts prompted the Navy to take the battlecruiser out of active service, and as the largest share of resources and manpower was consumed by Australia, which could be better used elsewhere, in August 1920, the battlecruiser was rated by the Naval Board as the 11th out of the Navy's 12 priorities. Accordingly, the ship's company was reduced later that year, and she was transferred to the Flinders Naval Depot as a gunnery and torpedo training ship. In the event of major conflict, she could be reactivated as coastal artillery, but couldn't be active as a active reserve because the Royal Australian Navy didn't even have enough crew to actually man her on short notice. To that end, she returned to Sydney in November 1921 and was paid off into reserve in December. By this time, battle cruisers built before the Battle of Jutland were considered obsolete, and there is no record of the Admiralty suggesting that Australia produce a replacement. Not that the Australian government would have agreed to do so, because considering at the time there's a prevailing anti-war sentiment amongst the population, and Australia was still financially crippled by the Great War, there was no way they could have purchased a new one. Also, as Australia was being prepared to be put out to pasture, one of the nails in her coffin was the Admiralty's decision to stop producing 12-inch ammunition shortly after the war, which would have necessitated the replacement of Australia's main armament once the Navy's stock of shells reached their expiration date. This wasn't financially reasonable for the Australian government, considering the Navy didn't even want Australia at this point. The 1922 Washington Naval Treaty was the Mutual Arms Limitation Disarmament Treaty between the major naval powers, basically to prevent United States and Great Britain from going to war with each other, was the death knell of HMAS Australia. One of the main aspects of the treaty was the limitation on the number and size of capital ships each nation possessed, and as the Royal Australian Navy was counted as part of the Royal Navy for the purposes of the treaty, Australia was one of the battlecruisers nominated for disposal to meet the British limit, and as a one final hurrah, so was HMS New Zealand.
Womp womp.
Now, both battlecruisers had to be... Yes. The battlecruisers had to be made unusable for warlike activities within 6 months of the treaty's ratification and then disposed of by scuttling, as Australia didn't have the facilities to break her up, and the British share of target ships had been taken up by Royal Navy vessels. At this time, this is the only time the Australian military has ever been affected by a disarmament treaty, until the 1997 Ottawa Treaty banning the use of anti-personnel mines. The Navy had already removed most of her equipment for use in other warships, and then they began the deliberate act of scrapping Australia by extracting piping and other fittings. In all, more than 30,000 pounds worth of material was retained for future naval use, and a further 35,000 pounds worth of fittings were removed and allocated to universities and technical colleges of various states. At least some of these remained regular use as though in at least the 1970s. On the 2nd of January 1924, the Defense Minister signed a contract with a syndicate which undertook the removal of everything else of value, and then secured the rights to sell the parts as souvenirs. By 3rd of January, 3rd of February, Australia was rendered unfit for warlike service. Originally, she was supposed to be scuttled on Anzac Day, the 25th of April, 1924, but was brought forward to the 12th of April, so the visiting British Special Service Squadron could participate in the festivities. She was towed to sea by tugs and sunk with her main armament in a position 95 degrees, 24 miles from Inner South Head, Sydney, on the 12th of April, 1924, which was due to the terms of the Washington Naval Treaty stipulating that she had to be sunk in water deep enough to make her resurfacing unfeasible. The former flagship was escorted by her siblings, the Australian warships Melbourne, Brisbane, Adelaide, Anzac, and Stalwart, the ships of the Special Service Squadron, and civilian ferries carrying passengers. Prime Minister Stanley Bruce provided a heartfelt eulogy, which was widely reported the night after she was scuttled. Quote, "In the prime of her service, this first great ship of the young Australian Navy was our contribution to the defense of civilization. In her passing, she symbolized our contribution to the cause of peace. We sacrifice her with a regret rendered poignant by the memory of her great service, but tempered with the hope that the world will see the magnitude of our offering." And the matter
they weren't going to mention the constant fighting with New Zealand or the mutiny.
No.
The hope of peace.
"She's tempered, but with the hope that the world will see the magnitude of our offering and the manner in which we make it, a measure of our practical belief in the principles enunciated by the Washington Conference, which constitute the only hope of a permanent international peace. The passing of Australia closes a glorious chapter in the history of the Australian Navy. We shall never forget that the eventful days of 1914, when the fate of civilization hung in the balance, it was the presence of Australia, manned by Australian seamen, that saved our shores and our shipping from the fate which overtook less fortunate nations," unquote. Now, most of her original complement volunteered to be part of the scuttling party, but only those who served aboard her were selected. At 2:30, the scuttling party set charges, opened all seacocks, and cleared the ship. Explosive charges blew a hole in the hull, and a few minutes later, it took 20 minutes for air water to fill the holes cut in the hull. The angle of list significantly increased, causing her three spare 12-inch barrels lashed to the deck to break free, and she rolled overboard. Australia inverted completely and began to sink stern first. She emerged submerged completely at 2:51, and a Royal Australian Air Force aircraft dropped a reef where the ship had sunk. Brisbane fired a rolling 21-gun salute, and the wreck was gazetted at being at 270 metres or 890 feet below the surface. However, there are discrepancies in the sources, and the exact location of Australia was lost until 1990, when a large unknown shipwreck was encountered by the Fugro Seafloor Survey Vessel MV Moana Wave 1, while surveying for undersea communications cables. I swear, Fugro finds every missing Australian vessel. They found AE-1, they found the Monteverde Maru, they found Perth.
Why haven't they put it on the missing airplane then?
They haven't been tasked yet.
I'm just saying.
Now, while they've got a special set of skills at this point. Yes,
how we go for it.
While Fugro suspected they had found Australia, they kept the information to themselves until 2002, when they announced it at a conference which caught the interest of the New South Wales Heritage Office, who requested confirmation. The size and location of the ship pointed towards it being Australia, but the depth meant verification through inspection could only be achieved by a remote-operated vehicle. The Navy was approached in 2007, but they lacked the ability to do so until March that year, when the United States Navy had loaned a deep-sea ROV to the government to locate and recover a Black Hawk helicopter that had crashed during the 2006 Fijian coup. While en route to Australia, the ROV was assigned to Fugro's coordinates at the request of the Heritage Office and verified that the ship was HMAS Australia. She had sunk, and while initially sinking stern first, she had leveled out as she sank, with the aftermast the first to strike the bottom. After hitting the seabed, Australia slid about 400 meters or 1,300 feet to her final resting place, and the wreck is protected under the Federal Historic Shipwrecks Act 1976. In total, 27 Australians died aboard her during her war service, of which overwhelmingly most of them would be from pneumonia. With accidents coming a close second, not a single Australian died from combat while aboard Australia. And she only fired her main arm in anger once.
Brave. So she really didn't get much of anything. She literally just sailed around a bit, looked impressive, and then got scuttled.
The saddest part about it is that she was lost less than 50 kilometers from Sydney. Like, they lost her. The government lost her. And it's like,
Where'd she go? Yeah. Oh, well, that is such a waste of a ship, but man, that's...
It's a shame they couldn't turn it into a museum. Like, I feel now, because, I have this discussion with a lot of people, when they're like, oh, how come all these houses always get destroyed, or the ships are, like, sunk purposely? And I'm like, because where we've had, like, peace for so long, we're much more historically minded, we're much more preservationist, whereas when you look at, like, medieval England, the Anglo-Saxons weren't looking at Roman ruins being like, oh, I'm going to preserve this, this is really historically important. You go, no, I don't want to get rained on. I don't want to get rained on. I want a house to live in. So, like, because people are much more survival, I think a lot of people don't realize that we actually have quite luxurious compared to our ancestors, like, who are much more survival minded. Sorry, little tangent there.
Yeah, well, one final slap in the face to Australia. New Zealand was sunk in September 1924.
So Australia
was scuttled in April. New Zealand lasted until September. One more final slap in the face.
I'm still standing. All right.
I like the idea they're in, like, the ship afterlife. New Zealand's just sitting there going, it's like, shut up.
No, that's
they're bullying each other in the afterlife.
I thought that one might be a better story than last time, where I depressed this everyone.
That one's a lot funnier compared to the submarine.
Since the crew just being at the bottom of the sea, like, hell. I mean, they were all dead instantly, apparently, but still. What's really sad is now you guys have to act surprised or something. Well, I guess you don't have to act surprised. I mean, I know you've already heard this.
I have the memory of a very, very stupid goldfish, so you're fine. Oh,
is there a smart goldfish?
There's a reason in all my videos I say names, like, and dates every time. It's not because I'm forget it, because I want to reference it. Because I'm reading a script being like, have I said this yet? Even though I have the script in front of me knowing I've already said it.
Oh, it's fair. Well, when we talked Shipwreck Summer, there was some shock because I was like, I'm not doing Titanic, which is what everyone thought. And yes, but it is, of course, Titanic adjacent. So, of course it is. So we're going to go back to Titanic just briefly for the context you need to get into this next story. Okay. We must first start on April 10th, 1912 in Southampton, because something's going to happen that's going to give us context to this story. But on April 10th, there's a shuffling of Titanic's crew. Captain E.J. Smith, who has been recently on the Olympic, and he brings in his chief officer, Olympic's Henry Wilde, who was not supposed to be on this journey, which sucks for him because he ends up dying and he wasn't even supposed to be there that day. So this causes a demotion for two crew members and ends with the original second officer, David Blair, being removed hastily. So Blair has to haul tail to get off the boat quickly. And he's been moving things out of his room. And who knows, because maybe he left some personal items behind. It was a very, very quick transition. But he took one very important thing with him as he leaves. And that is the set of keys to Titanic's binocular cabinet.
Ensuring they can't see anything. Yeah, that's true. It's very dark in the ocean at nighttime. Those videos terrify me when you see
that. Release the Kraken. Yeah, blackout. So it may have worked. But anyway, he also has had those moved around somewhere. So it's the only known set of keys to the binocular cabinet, but also the cabinet itself has just been kind of moved. So it's pure chaos. And we don't know if it would have helped or not. But so he's departing the Titanic. He carries those off with him. I mean, the Titanic at that point is still being painted and they're loading furniture on it because they were way behind schedule. The coal strikes, it screwed some stuff up. It was nuts. The only known set of keys to Titanic's binocular cabinet are in the pockets of that second officer, David Blair. But we don't know if that would have saved the Titanic because, I mean, there was only one set of look at those glasses being passed around amongst everyone. The lookouts didn't have them that night, but it was also pitch black. as Ryan pointed out, pitch black. You can't see your hand in front of your face. We don't have headlights or radar or anything like that yet. So some say it wouldn't have made a difference, but Frederick Fleet, the lookout, says it could have helped him spot it a few seconds earlier. Who knows? At any rate, once the fallout from the sinking subsides, the surviving second officer, my dude, Charles Lightoller, eventually runs into David Blair again later on. He has it out with him. What was said is a mystery, but we know Lightoller takes Blair into a private room and, according to Patrick Stinson, just berates the hell out of him. We don't know what was said.
Fight.
It's basically a big fight. Like, what the hell? Why did you take the keys to the binocular cabinet with you? But, you know, once they have said their piece to one another, it's just considered solved. They remain friends. Yep. I don't know how. But it's going to get tested again. The friendship is going to be tested again very shortly. But this wouldn't be the last time that Blair is going to be responsible, at least in part, for the destruction of a ship that Lightoller happens to be on. And so that's why today we are doing the story of the RMS Oceanic, or at the time, the HMS Oceanic. Here is a bit of backstory on that ship. It's one of the White Star Line's major flagship jewels for a long time. She was launched in 1899 from Harland and Wolff in Belfast. Queen of the Seas for a long time, pretty famous for her day. That was just kind of the ship that everybody got on when they were traveling across the world. At the end of journalist Nellie Bly's 80 Days Around the World trip that she took, that was very famous, she took the Oceanic back to the United States. It also survived a collision with another ship. That would be the SS Kinkara in 1901. The Kinkara did not fare as well, and at least 7 people were killed on the Kinkara. So
everyone's ramming everyone else's episode.
I don't know that I ever realized that was such a problem, because I'm just like, ocean's really big. And still, I don't know. That does happen quite a bit. I mean, the worst part of that is Smith had just wrecked the Olympic. He collided with something else, and they're like, you know what? He'll be fine taking the Titanic out. It's fine. The ships are getting too big. He just like almost destroyed the Olympic, but it'll be fine. Yeah.
Oh, you know, it's only like them messy things.
Hindsight 2020. All right. But most importantly, in terms of liking the Oceanic, this is also Titanic's, you know, senior surviving officer Lightoller's favorite boat. It's not the Titanic, which surprises people, but he didn't get the chance to like really be on the Titanic and get to love her, but he loved the Oceanic. So when World War I breaks out, the days of the ocean liners being numbered as they are, if they aren't being sunk by U-boats, they're run over mines or run aground. It's not a good time to be an ocean liner. They're going to be turned into hospital ships and warships. It's after the sinking of the Lusitania, of course, the Admiralty begins requisitioning ocean liners. What follows is this really weird setup of how the ship is run, because they don't want to get rid of the merchant marine crews, because the merchant marine crews know these ships, but they just basically bring on the Navy. So you have Royal Navy and some Royal Naval Reserve men who are both now Navy and merchant marine. And you have the worst part that creates a power struggle is that you have two different sects of leadership. You have the merchant marine crew on this ship and you have the Royal Navy. It kind of creates this power struggle because you have two leaders. You basically have crews divided into those two sets. The RMS Oceanic becomes the HMS Oceanic, and she has a merchant master, Captain Henry Smith, who does not have a Navy background, but you also have the naval captain, and that's Royal Naval Captain William Slater. David Blair is a lieutenant, and he's serving as a navigator, and Charles Lightoller is the first officer. So it's 1914, and the crew of the Oceanic are patrolling the waters near Fula. That's way up there in Scotland, I'm assuming kind of near, or past Shetland, I'm not quite entirely sure, but the Fula is surrounded by a very, very dangerous reef. And they are roaming around in that area, sort of between that Fula and Scotland and Norway. And that ship is outfitted to blow something up if needed and could stop any vessel. And it kind of stops and checks these German vessels for provisions and material. They're basically just keeping the waters clear. And but what we have going on the ship is also another war of sorts. It's a pissing contest between merchant marines who know the ship very well and know this route very well, and the very, very aggressive Navy. So they're zigzagging in these waters to avoid the U-boats. And William Slater is doing things to confuse everybody, like setting the clock back 40 minutes so that everyone would have to get into the general alert a bit earlier to avoid a vulnerable like time shift change from the
U-boat. That works so well.
It doesn't make any sense to me. Like, he's just thinking, like, if everybody think it's that same thing, like you're sneaking out, so you set the clock back a little early, so when you get in, your parents don't think, oh, she was out till midnight. Oh, she's back by 10. Then you forget to set it, and you're like, how many hours late for school the next day? It doesn't make any sense. But, yeah. So they're going to try to avoid any sort of like vulnerable shift changes. But Slater's also going to argue a lot with Smith about how close that ship can cruise to Fula, because the merchant crew knows that's a bad idea, but the Navy thought it was going to be fine. They don't know these waters as well as these merchant crews. But Blair as a navigator is so freaking exhausted by this point. Not the time change has been messing him up, but he also has to take that time change and put it into his calculations for navigation. Lightoller is on watch with Blair, who is like a college kid who just pulled out a full like a couple of all-nighters before a big final, and he's just barely functioning at this point. And at some point, Smith tells them to switch course, and they do, but Slater runs up the bridge. He's like, whoa, who told you to, you know, shift this course? I want you to go this way. And of course, it was Smith, the merchant guy. He's like, well, I'm Royal Navy. We're going to go do this my way. So they switch back to the way that was putting them in danger.
Oh, this isn't going to end well.
No, but by this point, Blair is so tired that he just like basically begs Slater and Smith, let me sleep for like an hour and a half. I beg you. And they eventually say, okay, yeah. So they let Blair go get a cat nap, which is like nothing.
Yeah.
Lightoller's watch also ends, and he gets to be in the position of, thankfully, once again, somehow not being the person who was on the bridge when shit hits the fan. He manages to go downstairs and sleep through this one as well. So good for him.
Blair. There's a lot of like, what's going on here?
No, I'm out. So he just barely misses this, like, because he missed the Titanic and the iceberg like by about an hour and 45 minutes is what he was off. Blair had been forced to change those coordinates once more with that last lift from like very last shift from Slater. Let me go back and take off my Facebook, and I'll go back and read that sentence again because I didn't realize my Facebook was open. No. All right. So Blair had been forced to change the coordinates so often that eventually he makes a mistake in his math. Now, Slater thought they'd miss Fula, but as it turned out, they were right on top of it. But instead of taking evasive action, because the Navy guy thought he was the best guy in the room, he thinks turning out west to sea is going to save it, but that just drags them into this reef, dragging and scraping along the bottom of this giant ship. So 20 minutes after Lightoller had gotten off the bridge, there was a bunch of screaming and yelling, and he just kind of is like, okay. He sticks his head out. And then the Oceanic had run aground on those reefs that the merchant crew had been warning the Navy guys about. So, yeah,
the, I mean, the Navy is really, because the Navy is really pointed at this point to be a rational entity.
Yeah.
When the Titanic hit the iceberg, he was dozing off in his cabin the same as this time. So he must have just been like, are you kidding me right now? So he goes back up the bridge where he learns what's happening with everything. And he has to realize at that moment that Davy Blair is the one who ran the ship aground with his bad calculations. Now, technically, it's not entirely Blair's fault here, and Blair is really tired, but oh my God. So Lightoller never really talks. Lightoller never really talks affectionately about anybody in his own writings. Like, he's a military guy through and through, or Navy guy through and through. And he's like, yeah. The Oceanic, however, this is his baby, and the man damn near cries. He loves this ship. Thankfully, no one will die in this incident, so that's the good part here. But the ship is beyond saving, and the abandoned ship order is given, and they run to help everyone get off the boat. Now with these drills, they're now accustomed to working with those davits that swing out. They had so much trouble with those on Titanic that it was completely drilled in their heads on how to use those. But the crew isn't sure exactly what he's doing, but Lightoller gets everyone off the boat. He's in charge of lifeboats, just like Will Murdoch was, and Henry Wilde was on Titanic. But then he decides that when he gets off, he's like, wait a minute, hang on, there's nobody on board. So he just decides to run back on the boat. The crew isn't exactly sure what he's doing, but he sort of just disappears on an empty ship. And they thought maybe he was doing a rounds to double check it. But in reality, what he was doing was saying goodbye to the ship that he loves more than anybody he's ever met in his life, the ship of his boyhood ambition, and knowing the Oceanic is going to wash away or be scrapped, He runs back onto the bridge, jumps up, and rips a clock off the wall. His crew finds him crawling back down to the lifeboat with the bridge clock as a souvenir. And when all is said and done,
because that's...
I mean, you know, run with it. It was just going to get scrapped.
Because that's what you do when your ship is sinking, you loot it.
I mean, why not? Let's loot. Oh, well, at least he made sure everybody was off first before he looted, so we'll give him that.
I would have definitely pretended all that. Yeah, I was just checking for everyone, and then the clock just was on the floor, and I thought, you know, well, might as well.
I was setting it back to 40 minutes where it should because the Navy guy messed it up. No, I don't know. Anyway, when all is said and done, despite the bad behavior of the two leaders, and I feel terrible here, but Smith and Slater, they're not blamed at all for this. The entirety of the blame is going to fall on sweet little David Blair and his faulty navigations, even though Slater was making his life a living hell by changing things up, and there was push and forth, you know, go back and forth between the two.
Poor guy was just trying his best.
Because he was really tired, and they kept changing things. All right, so 2 weeks later, the Oceanic broke apart in a massive storm, and her pieces drifted away. Some pieces were salvaged years later, but there are still, like, outside the full of the engines and a few other parts that remain in those reefs out there. So, to be clear, Davy Blair was not... Let me just choke myself there. To be clear, Davy Blair was not a bad sailor. He just seemed to be a little unlucky. As for the clock Charles Lightoller stole on the way out, that lived on his motor yacht, Sundowner, which he used in the Dunkirk evacuation. And after Sundowner was sold... This is where I turn into Liam Neeson. After Sundowner was sold, there appears to be a mystery about where that clock is now. If it's in the Maritime Museum that used to house Sundowner, it's closed and you can't get in. Or if one of her former owners kept the clock, I will find you.
Liam Neeson style.
No, because we actually cannot figure out where this clock is. Years later, Lights planned a trip to an island. I love this. He got shipwrecked on as a boy, St. Paul's Island. And years later, he wants to go back, and he planned to take David Blair with him on Sundowner.
Leave him there.
No. But at that point, Lightoller's wife looked at him like, are you dumb? Why are you? Anytime he's in close proximity with this man, something terrible happens. Needless to say, the trip never happened, and we still don't know where that clock is. I'll find it. I'm going to find it, though. The end. Ta-da! Yeah.
You probably will find it.
I'm convinced it's in the museum. Because the museum, well, the museum, the Ramsgate one was the one that had it, and it like was a hot mess. It burnt, there was a fire, some things got destroyed, but now they're engaged in some sort of legal action with the lease of the building, so everything in there's inventory. But there's items, I'm like, it's in there somewhere. I'm
gonna go. you're gonna do like an estate sale. You're gonna like one like they do with
like
the
estate sale or like Nicolas Cage in National Treasure.
Or one of those like storage wars, like storage wars.
You not get like English Heritage or someone to like intervene or National Trust, National Trust, useless. English Heritage would probably be English Heritage would be the best one to go for.
If only we had someone who was English who could.
No,
I actually, you know what? I know people who work for English Heritage. Now I think about it.
But they had before I found out who had Sundowner and I went and saw it. They were not answering my emails. They were still, like, their website was still up. They still advertised themselves to be the home of Sundowner, but apparently, like, they were just letting everything in that museum just rot. And when they started up, the stuff was falling off the side of the boat because it was just, the engine had not been oiled in so long that it vibrated the paneling, and some of the paneling had been covered by white paper. It's the most horrible thing I've ever seen. So I will go Liam Neeson if I ever get in there, but I think it's in that museum. Somewhere.
You know, once the legal stuff's over there, because I have a funny feeling that even the heritage sites will have when legal stuff goes down in the UK, it's a lot more hardcore than it is in America. Things get locked down. We just like.
Oh yeah, no, they have that all as inventory because his granddaughter has a painting that her mother gave them to that she loaned them, and she can't get it back out. It's kind of insane how much it's just locked up completely.
Is there a deadline for how long this is going to last? Like, is there any hope that we could one day get in there and start finding artifacts rot completely?
Yeah, I mean, one, there was a fire in that building. I'm like, why haven't you taken the stuff out after the fire? But I don't know how much, like, there was some, like, actual old stuff that was very significantly old. like older than America stuff that just got destroyed. But there's a bunch of stuff related to Sundowner in the museum and we just can't get to it. It's annoying. But that's it. So, yes. All right, kids. I'll see you in a bit. Thanks, Ross. Go to bed.
Yeah, I'm going to bed. All right. Thanks. See you guys.
You are out. Okay, okay.
Thank you once again, Melissa and Ryan, for joining me on the finale of History Shock's Shipwreck Summer. It definitely was a lot of fun to collaborate with them and something I definitely want to do in the future, if the time zones manage to line up. Now, Melissa is a journalist slash theater kid slash history nerd who somehow managed to amass a following over on TikTok. She's the host of God's Favorites, a history podcast, and is working to save the Sundowner, a Dunkirk little ship that belonged to Titanic's second officer, Charles Lightoller, though she swears she has a personality beyond that one thing. She can be found on TikTok at Melissa Fairlady, and the link to her podcast and the GoFundMe to save the Sundowner will be in the show notes. Ryan is a history buff, filmmaker, and writer who creates comedic and educational content surrounding history slash mythology and folklore, and is well known for his love of Alexander the Great. Now, he may or may not have an Alexander body pillow, but only he will know the truth. He can be found at History Daddy on YouTube, TikTok, and Instagram. Links to everything will be in the show notes. As for us, I was only doing my job, and Australian Military History Podcast is made possible thanks to the generous support from each and every one of you, but in particular, our Armoured Emu Brigade community. Now, if you want to join in on the conversation, you can do so over on our social media channels. At this point, the podcast is on everything. And if you want to join the Armoured Emu Brigade community, you can do so over on our Discord server. Links to everything are on our website as well as in the episode description. But if you want to support the podcast, you now have two options. You can either buy the podcast a one-off coffee or join us on Patreon for ongoing support. Each cent given goes directly into digitization of records, as well as distribution and licensing. We seem to have hit a chord with the population of Ashburn, Virginia, as it and the United States are still our most popular country to listen to the podcast. So a shout out to whoever is following us there. Now, if you enjoy this or any other episode in the series, please leave a review or share it with a friend, as it is the best way to get the show in the ears of people who need to hear it. Until next time, friends, catch you then. Bye. Thanks for listening to the I Was Only Doing My Job, Australia's Military History Podcast, a Doc Network production. This episode was recorded on the lands of the Gangdangara people, whose elders have passed on knowledge for thousands of years, and we pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. This episode was written, researched, produced, directed, and audio engineered by me, Ross, with additional research done by Laurie Favell of My Silent Hero. If you do know someone whose story needs to be told, feel free to leave a comment on an episode or send us an email at iwasonlydoingmyjobpod@gmail.com. If you like what we do here and you want to support this podcast, the best thing you can do is share this with a friend or leave a review on your favorite podcast platform, as it really helps others find the show. And if you want to join in on the conversation, join us over on Discord. And if you want more content, including show notes, photos, transcripts, and my various adventures finding memorials dotted around Australia, head over to our website at www.thedocnetwork.net and follow the show on all our social media pages at IWODMJ. Don't worry, there are links to everything in the show notes. Join me personally for more bite-sized history over on TikTok and pretty much everywhere else at Doc Winters. All opinions expressed in this episode are solely those of the speaker and do not reflect the views or opinions of any entity, agency, or organization. It is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike 4.0 International License. Thanks for listening. Catch you next time. Bye.